This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Welcome to Thursday Breakfast's summer programming on 3CR Community Radio. Today's show features a selection of interviews we've done with artists, writers, video game designers, and filmmakers. We hear about the importance of disabled oracles, the first ever Aboriginal mobile game, and Family Music Collective EP, Bloodfire, and the short film Sistermine and Fighting Against Carcism. Now stay tuned for a beautiful episode on 3CR 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and streaming at 3cr.org.au or via the Community Radio app.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are now going to hear writer, artist, and 3CR's Disability Day coordinator, Pauline Vatuna, sharing some reflections on the work of disabled oracles in transforming the world in the wake of the recent passing of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong. Pauline also reflects on the importance of critically attending to how we practice solidarity and community with disability justice at the core, disabled ancestorhood, and this year's upcoming Disability Day special broadcast, which will be held on the 3rd of December on 3CR 855 AM.
So firstly, I just want to thank you, Priya, for inviting me to share some words on the passing of who I think was one of the most important disability liberation and human liberation thinkers of our time. You asked me to begin by discussing the promise and pitfalls of appeals to solidarity and community through a disability justice lens. And so I think it's good to get some definitions on the table first. So disability rights in the Western world began with disabled people valiantly fighting their way out of institutionalization. And so efforts by disabled people and the people close to them to be able to access, you know, the basic amenities of living in society and live independently, free from violence. So disability rights, to a large extent, is still about that. Disabled people or people with disabilities are still having to fight for access on so many fronts and so many levels of policy, most notably in an Australian context, independent living and housing, healthcare, income support and accessibility to everything a human being needs to live a life and participate in society. So you can see from that disability rights is fighting for things that all people need, all pre-disabled people. Disability justice, however, takes it further. As a framework, it is inherently about liberation beyond what currently exists. So beyond colonial racial capitalism, beyond carceral systems, and beyond empire. So it's a broader agenda of change, and it recognises that not only are all people pre-disabled and deserve to live and have their needs met, that in order for that to be a reality, we have to radically challenge and change the very root of oppression, which necessitates that we develop coherent understandings of how all of these movements for justice are interconnected and how oppression creates disability and debility on Earth, disabling not just people, but animals and ecosystems as well. So you can see in my basic definitions that the differences between them sort of mirror the differences between liberal notions of progressive human rights changes within existing institutions of society versus radical, ground roots up, materialist efforts of liberation beyond the institutions of colonial capitalism, the nation state, and the whole international system. However, with disability and disabled lives, the line between those two is blurrier because of the nature of vulnerability under capitalism that disabled people face. Because many disabled people are reliant on care and on the state in order to just live, we have to both fight for policy changes that affect our ability to simply exist, to get and maintain welfare, to get and maintain housing, healthcare, transport, basic community infrastructure, at the same time as we dream radically beyond what exists and try to build futures beyond eugenics and colonial capitalism. So circling back to your question again, all of these things that I just talked about require solidarity and community building. These are really the only ways that humans can get free, and disabled people know this more than most. So a lot of our advocacy has to, unfortunately, focus on, you know, helping pre-disabled people understand that their liberation can only come about with a thorough understanding of disability rights and disability justice into their freedom work. Because other than premature death, the major consequence of all forms of oppression is disability. It is the disabling of minds and bodies and spirits. So it really transcends all of our different identities, while at the same time our identities can make us bigger targets for violence in society, which is, you know, the essence of intersectionality. So disability rights and disability justice work is really deeply vulnerable work. It's really challenging. It requires levels of nuance and a breadth of understanding that I think actually makes disabled people real assets to human freedom. But ableism and eugenics is literally killing off some of the best amongst us. This is something Alice Wong talked about frequently, and she also embodied it. So yes, that does bring me to Alice Wong, who sadly passed away in a hospital from an infection this past week. She was just 51 years old. I personally describe her loss as unquantifiable. I think she was an absolute force of nature in disability rights and also championed disability justice, particularly in relation to Palestine and the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Alice was one of the disabled people behind Crips Free Sims for Gaza, which was a fundraising effort to purchase eSIMs for people in Gaza. And together they actually raised millions of dollars. Alice had actually spent a huge amount of time in hospitals over the past few years, and a lot of her advocacy in recent times centered on two big challenges: the genocide of the Palestinian people and the abandonment of medically vulnerable people through the removal of COVID mitigations, especially in medical settings. Alice was one of those vulnerable people. She needed people to mask around her, and consistently when not around her, because she couldn't mask herself due to a breathing apparatus she had to wear. During hospitalization, she faced doctors, nurses, other staff members and administrators not wearing respirator masks around patients, which is wild. Alice did not pull punches. She was loud about the insidious eugenics at the core of so much of the official public health policies concerning COVID and long COVID. I've actually seen an enormous outpouring of grief and gratitude from COVID-conscious people, including parents of medically vulnerable children who desperately need solidarity to stay safe. So Alice said over and over again, masking for others is community care. Now, if you search online for Alice Wong's work on any platform, you will find a massive digital history of her extensive efforts to publish and advance the stories, the perspectives, and the dignity of people with disabilities in the United States, where she was born. But she also supported disabled people across the English-speaking world. I met Alice in 2021, when we delivered a webinar together, and I really cherish that moment and that memory. She was incredibly generous with her encouragement and her wisdom, and I think the outpouring of grief and anecdotes being shared online is a testament to this. I think Alice's own writing was genius. I urge you to read her books and her essays, because she was a genuine visionary, and I think this is best experienced rather than spoken about. Having said that, though, I did read the words of a Black Irish disability advocate named Blessing Dada, who said this: seeing someone whose politics, body, culture, and survival strategies reflect yours. In her, I found a mirror, a mentor, and a map. What she meant to me is incomprehensible. She showed me that representation is not a luxury. It is survival. It is power. It is a form of care. She's left behind a blueprint for a radically accessible, interdependent, anti-eugenic, anti-colonial future. To honour her is to live more boldly into the world she envisioned. The task now is to transform the world in the direction she pointed. Now, Priya asked if I could talk about the Disability Oracle Society, and so in my remaining minutes with you, let me do so. So before she passed, Alice Wong had for a long time advanced this idea of disabled people being the seers, the oracles of the world, those who can see things through pattern recognition, heightened sensitivity, alternative senses, intuition, before they happen. I think what she meant by this is that we have to attune so well to those who affect our lives, which is all non-disabled people, carers, institutions, political trends, that our survival depends upon our ability to see through time and perceive both the dangers and the opportunities of different courses of collective action we could take, and then use our voices and creations to warn others, herald good news, bring forth solutions to our biggest challenges as a species through time. So the Disabled Oracle Project is an archive of such transmissions from beyond time. It was founded by Alice Wong and some of her friends. One part of the project is a website featuring telegrams by disabled oracles to the world, in the form of text, video, audio, and graphic art. It is a living chorus and archive of disabled wisdom from the past, present, and future. Now, the whole project was actually inspired by a talk that Alice Wong delivered back in 2020. It was called The Last Disabled Oracle, and it featured as part of the Assembly for the Future, which is a project of the Things We Did Next collaboration based here in Nam, actually, in Melbourne, Australia. And I actually broadcast that talk on the Disability Day broadcast in 2020. You can listen to it at 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2020. And if you tune into this year's Disability Day broadcast on December 3rd, you will hear more disabled oracles. The theme this year is Right Relations and Innovations, and you can find the full program at 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2025.
Thank you so much, Pauline, for sharing those beautiful and profound reflections and lessons, not just those of Alice Wong, but those of other disabled oracles and, a whole movement of disabled activists and disability justice warriors over time who have really been pointing us towards, a future otherwise, and the revolutionary transformation of the world, which, as you talk about, has implications for all of us. Everyone who is not currently disabled is only pre-disabled. And so I really hope that people sit with what you've shared and go look at the Disability Visibility Project, the Disabled Oracle Project, and everything else that you have referenced. That was writer, artist, and 3CR's Disability Day coordinator Pauline Vituna sharing some reflections on the impact of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong and on the work of disabled oracles in transforming the world, as well as the importance of critically attending to how we practice solidarity and community with disability justice at the core. And remember again to stay tuned to 3CR 855 AM on the 3rd of December for this year's Disability Day special broadcast.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
It's the government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans, but too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/suck eggs to learn more. The Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
We have an in-studio interview with Elijah McDonald and Rosie Kalila. Elijah McDonald is a Noongar Pina Pina Yamaji Tech Artist Junior Programmer, and Rosie is a Wemba Wemba Gunjumara Art and Cultural Producer from Blacktasia, this continent's first ever Aboriginal mobile game, and they join us in the studio to talk about making of the game, art, inspiration, and the everyday work it takes to make a game by Mob for Mob. How are you both today?
Good, thank you for having us.
So I wanted to start off by saying, why was this game important to make for you?
Yeah, so for us, we're all black fellas, we've all played games growing up, and there hasn't really been any games that have black fellas in it, and you know, all of our culture coming into like the game design especially. There's been a few things where there's been like one or two black characters, but nothing quite like this, where it highlights the kind of rich animals and landscapes and people in Australia.
Yeah, amazing. What kind of games were you playing growing up where you're like, I really want more of this in my life?
To be honest, a lot of games. Yeah. It's quite hard to put something exact to that, but yeah, just all the games that I played growing up, you know, like there was stuff like, you know, Sid Meier's Civilization. I remember playing like Tasmanian Tiger, which did have a lot of like motifs of Australian like culture in it, but it wasn't quite there, you know. So yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's really beautiful even looking on the Instagram. Like, all the art is so incredibly special and beautiful and really meticulous. So I was wondering what are kind of the components needed to make this happen, because having a game come off the ground is no easy feat with, like, a big team. So, yeah, how does a game get made?
To start off with, there was a lot of pre-production, so planning around just the world and the core mechanics of it. So we had our lead game designer, Phoebe Watson. She spent a lot of time working on just figuring all of that out and trying to find a game design that felt right for us and felt good for Mob, who are, you know, we're making this game for. So at that point, at the start, there was a much smaller team, but as we've progressed through development, we've, you know, brought on a lot more people, more artists, more programmers, and yeah, so it's just really grown there. And yeah, bringing on people who have a lot of knowledge in different aspects of game development. So, you know, myself, I do some of the programming and technical art, you know, obviously Phoebe with the game design and writing as well. We also had, like, Patricia McKean. She's a Ganichmara artist, so she's working on, like, concepts and that. We also have Charlotte Allingham, who's our creative director, so she was coming in with a lot of the creative direction, art direction, and also being the principal artist on the project, so she was pumping out a lot of the art as well. So, yeah, just bringing in lots of different people. That was kind of the main thing there, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. When you're thinking about, like, even just drawing, or is it, like, frame by frame, or are you animating, like, zooming out? I don't know how any of it works, so yeah. I'm just curious.
So it's all broken up into a lot of different programs. So there's this one we use, Blender. It's like a 3D like animation program. So we've got some people making the, like, the animals and the characters, and then you come in and, like, animate that sort of frame by frame, and then doing all the little in-betweens on that. But yeah, there's a lot of different programs, so the process is quite different across all of them.
Yeah, like, for sure.
I'm mostly in the game engine Unity, doing, yeah, a bit of the programming and kind of bringing in all of the art that everyone's made into the game itself. So, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, I guess, why did you choose this particular game design, and where did these inspirations come from?
Yeah, so with the game design, it was all about creating something that made sense to the First Nations audience. So in terms of the game design, it was all about creating these kind of a game design mechanics that really resonate with First Nations audience. So, because we've noticed, we did a lot of community playtesting. So throughout those, we kind of saw that the things that we were doing did line up with that. So a big part of the game is planting all the native plants, and those plants are specific to the levels, which are then inspired by specific parts of Australia as well. So, you know, we've had some of the older people, especially, that when they come in, they, even though it's not entirely necessary to do so, they tend to plant and design their space according to how their country is and all of the things that they know about it. And yeah, especially the kids as well, they really get into that.
Yeah, wonderful. I think there's so many beautiful characters to choose from. I was curious about what some of your favorite characters or areas in the games were.
You want to answer that one, Rosie?
I want to say the Land Defender Bush Mechanic girl. She is everything. Her outfit is just so cool. Like, I literally want to wear it myself. She's got these really cool, you know, chaps on, and there's, like, Aboriginal flag incorporated into the design as well, in on her kind of overalls. And she's just so, like staunch and sweet at the same time. And that's what I love about her so much. The actual artwork done by Charlotte Ellingham is, it's so joyous, but it's also staunch at the same time. And I love that so much. And that reflects what the game really is. And, you know, when you're cleaning up country, she's always there just saying, hey, you know. So I think that would be my favourite. I can't stop thinking about her at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. Staunch and sweet. Love that. What about you, Elijah?
To be honest, I'd have to agree. especially the belt that she's wearing. It's got a belt buckle on it that says Landback. And yeah, just really love that character as well. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. And I guess when it comes to the behind the scenes every day for the team, I'm sure there's so many different moving parts. But yeah, I guess what does it feel like to be part of the first Aboriginal mobile game every day at work?
To be honest, I get so caught up in just working on it that I kind of forget.
Yeah.
And then when it is mentioned, it's feels a bit unreal, you know. But it makes me very happy to be a part of this project and working on it and working with all the mob on it. It's really special, yeah.
Yeah, I'd have to say coming in only last week, really, as new arts and culture producer for these mob, it's like really incredible what you've all done. And so I think it is one of those things where you're like, you've been in it and developing it so much with all of the technical assets. And I'm coming in and I'm just like in awe every day. I'm like, wow, this is what you have been doing. So for me, it's a huge privilege and honor. And I feel incredibly proud to be stepping into this space and to see how the development has come along. And I'm so excited for, you know, what we can do next.
Yeah, beautiful. I am so in awe of like all your responses, and Alice is kind here, but everybody's like smiling and cheesing over how special this is. And I can tell it's really close to both of your hearts as well. And so much love has been poured into this game. And I guess when we're taking it offline into the world, what has the Blacktasia launch been at the big games night out?
Yeah, so last year, yeah, we launched the Blacktasia original soundtrack at Big Games Night Out in Fed Square. sorry, excuse me.
It's okay.
It was unreal to see all of the people there. There was, you know, a good couple hundred, and we were putting on, you know, we're showing some of the songs that we've got for the OST for the first time to the public. And we also had like line dancing. So we got everyone involved in that. we showed everyone how to do it and everyone was getting involved in that. And just seeing people's faces as well when they're listening to that. There's a lot of families there as well. And it just really made me smile to see everyone there and getting to share what we've been working on for so long with everyone. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. With the like the original soundtrack, especially, like what kind of vibe?
Yeah.
Or like what kind of impact did you want to have on the audience with the music? Because that's such an important part of a video game. I feel like there's so much of the music of the games that I used to play is like the main things that stand out to me.
One of the biggest influences has kind of been like country music. So our composer, Robert K. Champion, he's from over in South Australia, been doing like country music for a few decades now, I think. But he came in with that kind of influence to the game because he also has helped influence like the game design as well. He's associate game designer, so he works with like me and Phoebe on some of the mini games in it as well. But yeah, with the music and kind of the country and western theme of the game as well, he was a big influence on that, bringing that in. And so a lot of the music, he just came up with it, you know. Like each song kind of was just in the moment, some of it for him. And then we'd take that and then work with him in building that up into a full song.
Yeah, nice. How does the music or the animation just change when you're like defeating? Is it the murk?
Yes.
Defeating the murk, like cleaning up the bush. Like, yeah, how does the different zones of the game come out?
Yeah, so the murk is this evil entity that's taken over the land and really corrupted everything. So you're fighting it back throughout the game, and each level is kind of unlocked by fighting back the murk. And then after you've cleared it, you are then free to kind of go through and clean up everything and bring back life to the land by planting all the native plants. And as you progress, you're also then bringing back all the native animals as well. So in the first level, you're after you've beaten the murk there, you bring back an echidna, and the echidna has its own little mini game. All the animals in the game, they have their own little mini games as well, and they're kind of designed around some kind of aspect of that animal.
Yeah, beautiful. What was there a recent mini game that was released? Was it Dingo recently?
Nah, but we've shown off the dingo that we've made for the game.
Oh, yeah. Yep, okay, yep. That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah. we haven't got anything out just yet, but we were showing off the dingo that we made because we went out to the dingo sanctuary in Victoria, and dingoes are, I think, a really important animal in Australia, especially in terms of like the ecosystem and kind of maintaining a balance there. So it was really important for us to bring that in and make sure that we have a dingo in the game somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And I know that we spoke a little bit about the launch of Fed Square. I can't believe having it in Fed Square and like doing line dancing is so wonderful. I can't imagine what that would have been like. But I'm wondering, what the reception to the game has been throughout development. I remember in one of your other interviews, Elijah, you talking about kids coming up to you and being like, I love this game.
Yeah. It is the sweetest thing ever. When we get to see, especially the kids, come and play it, because we've designed the game to be very kid focused. So like, young mob is primarily who we made it for, but it's also all ages and everyone can play it. But yeah, just seeing them play it, it reassures us that we're doing everything right because of the very positive feedback we get. Because we've been doing, a lot of community playtesting, and then just this year going up to Yarwin Festival and Share the Spirit in Melbourne. Some of the kids were very eager to keep playing, they can't stay on the game forever, unfortunately, at least until it comes out.
Nice.
But it just makes me very happy, and I think the rest of the team shares that as well. Yeah.
Amazing. And I know that it's such an incredible feat, and I was wondering if you both or had any advice for First Nations mob creative and game designers who are thinking about starting their own projects or like getting into something, game design.
Yeah, I would say just jump into anything really. If you've got access to a computer, you can really just do what you want and just start playing around and figuring things out. There's plenty of game jams online that you can join up with some friends or some people online and just start making games, really, and get connected with other mob like ourselves as well. You can shoot us a message on like our Instagram or whatever, or email, just get to know other people that are interested in working in that space as well. Yeah,
for sure. And lastly, how can we play?
Yeah, so the game will be coming out around the end of the year or maybe January, so December, January, and it'll be for free on the Google Play and Apple stores. So, yeah, if you follow us on our Instagram, TikTok, whatever, we're Blacktasia _game. That's our app. And yeah, just keep an eye out for when it comes out. It'll be 100% free.
Amazing. Yeah, we could definitely put that in our show notes. But yeah, for both of you, do you have anything else that you wanted to add before we wrap up?
We are very excited that we will have a stall at PAX this year in October, so a few months away from the 10th to the 12th of October at Melbourne Convention Centre. So that will be a really cool opportunity for people to see, you know, physically, you know, the artwork and also the gameplay and get to see a little bit more before the game launches.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Rosie and Elijah, for coming on the show today. We'll have more information about Blacktasia.
Hi, everyone. My name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website, 3cr.org.au, or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, and now we are joined by Poro, who is a member of Family, a collective born at the intersection of Pacifica, Black, Queer and Trans experiences. Joining us to discuss their EP Bloodfire, released yesterday, as well as their short film and their upcoming show tonight at the Northcote Theatre. Thanks so much for joining us here today, Poro.
Hello, good morning, Christina.
Good morning. It's such an honour to have you on the show. And I really was reflecting on the show that you did in July and how really electric and defiant it was. I'm wondering if you could talk about what it was like to perform in July and why you want to do the encore show tonight.
Oh, it was a mixed feeling. It was magical. It was an honour and... It was like galactic collusion. That was the best expression that I can send out there in regards to the experience of performing. And yeah, and it was our first time, you know, come together and emerging from our different creative practices. And yeah, it was exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time. So at the first gig, we were a bit nervous. And the second gig, we were trying to send it with more energizer. And I feel like the audience also feeling it. And because of there are a lot of people missing out, so that's why we create another encore gig, which happening tonight from our... second release, I call the outlet.
Yeah, I know that you have released the Bloodfire EP yesterday, and we just played Our Blood earlier, which people were texting us saying, what a beautiful song. And I know there was also the short film that was released, and I really felt the feelings of like fire and resistance through the EP as well as the visual film. And I'm wondering, how you, if you've thought about how to convey those themes differently through the EP and the film.
Yes, so I'm not missing out explaining in regards to who we are, which is we are Oceania and First Nations collective, and we're using this platform, a family platform, as a canoe to exercising our custodianship within the urban and suburban context. And in this means we exercising through the elements of ecosystem, which is the fire, the air, the water, and the earth, and relate to the extensions of our humanism, which is the structure in our body, the anatomy in our body, which is the blood, flesh, the bones, and the spirit. And that's why this first EP born out of the combinations of the blood and the fire. And the theme, this theme we take into different products of the songs that we created from the different members of the family. So that's where Firekeeper born out of, you know, the spirit and the fire. And to tell the audience, to tell the family, to tell the relatives out there that there's existing fire within us that's still burning, especially at this time where, you know, neoliberal militarism and fascist internationals are rising and spreading, and there's a need of all of us, the humanism that derive over custodianship, to keep exercising ceremony and rituals. And that's why we're inspired a lot by the sun, which is, for me, is the highest deity who creates and provides. You know, without sun, there's no photosynthesis, there's no oxygen, there's no life growth and human continuity. So the fire and the sun are the highest deity who able to create a human survivability. So Firekeeper derived over that, you know, it's a source of power. And then the Owl Blood is also, Firekeeper is made by me, Paul BB, and Danny, Fiona, Bella, the curator, Ripley Kavara, and has been cooked by the producer, also the guy, Steph, Sione also involved, Ripley also involved. And then the second song, which is Blood, Our Blood, which is relations of, you know, the blood and the river. And in here, we have the chorus sing by a really beautiful, wonderful matriarch, Kalala. And it's a work of me, Probibi, Kalala, Ripley, and Sione. And it's a, how, you know, like the river streams is also extensions of our existence. The streams, the bloods that run in our body, because once you pass away, you're going back to the aquifer and then going to the water circle and then continue, you know, so the existing spirit of usness, you know, within the ecosystem. So, Our Blood, and the chorus say My Blood, because in indigenous thinking is, me is the extension of all of us, so there's an usness in there, so...
Yeah, yeah, I really feel that listening to it and being in the space and watching the movie, like, it is alive, it's transgressive, it's part of an ecosystem. And, you know, being from a collective as well. I was curious about when you're rehearsing and like coming up with these ideas, you're pulling from so many different environments and cultures and histories. And I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit more about what it's like to be in that rehearsal space or in the production space and, you know, hear from other people's ideas. And yeah, how do you bring a entire EP together when you have so many incredible, important lineages to honour?
Yes. It's like the best metaphor is like a canoe, you know. When you, the collective is like a canoe. So Ripley cut the woods, and then there's a guy, there is Steph, there is Sione, there is Kalala, and Iki, and me, and Bella, and everyone, and Danny, everyone have a role and responsibility in that canoe. So, when I say about like how this is the place where we're exercising custodianship within the suburban like context, this is where we have a fire circle gathering. So in a way, like there's a inner mystics for us to create that hospitality. It's part of an aesthetic Oceania cosmoism, which is hospitality. And in there, we're trying to best ourselves to provide, you know, the best environment for all of us. And then also the stimulant of the ecosystem, which is a place where we have a gathering, which is Biruruma, the upstreams of the Yarra Yarra River, which is... There is a really, really, it was a great place, great stimulant for us to create and to gather. And yeah, the roles means we care for the beingness inside us, which means there's a food, there's space for all of us to, for different feelings and expressions and emotions and, yeah, like the gathering, it's like family.
Yeah.
Family.
Yes.
That, family that, you know, like in this time of postmodernist, posthumanist, where everything mediated, all the socials are mediated, we feel so related to each other because, yeah, it's just. When you break down culture, like in the ocean, it's like this: the fire in here that we used to cook, the same fire they used to cook in many different, you know, places in the island. But it's just like today there's ideas of exploitation and commercialization over, you know, how to use the fire. People thought that, you know, oh yeah, I have money, so I have access to fire. But then, you know, indigenous life, we use fire to cook. So, like, how can we get rid of the ideas of exploitation and commercialization and still maintain that custodianship? So I feel like when we gather, we're trying to take that ideas of custodianship. So, yeah.
I can definitely feel that in the... Yeah, it's transgressive the way... even in the rehearsal space where you're talking about it and how you relate to each other and allow that space. And I think it really translates on stage. You have, like, all of family, the entire show is such a masterclass in, like, tension and release and control of the audience. And I'm wondering, when it comes to the show tonight and where you would like the collective to go, could you tell us a little bit more about what you're hoping for?
Yes, so tonight, I forget to mention it, but like, we really touch on the ideas of humanism. That's why the audience are very, very experienced that, you know? You know, like, that's the beauty of get together, you know? And then tonight, there will be another beautiful artist performing, Chiaki, Kyupuru, and tonight we rearrange some songs and a couple new songs, and Kalala is back. So.
Woohoo!
And yeah, it's just, I can't spoil you, but, you know, if you want to experience some magical, you know, evenings, so tonight just come through.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we've, I remember the last show being so magical, and yeah, you definitely don't want to miss it, and I think it's going to be so incredibly special, and we'll have links in our show notes on how to attend and buy tickets, but it's Thursday, the 27th of November tonight, 7 p.m. at the Northcote Theatre. But thank you so much, Pura, for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Ines. Thank you, and yeah, thanks for having me, Blessing, and...
Oh, blessing is mine. Pleasure is mine. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
And that was Pura, a member of Family, a collective born at the intersections of Pacifica, Black, Queer and Trans experiences, joining us to discuss the EP Bloodfire, as well as their short film, and what it means to be transgressive and honour music in ancestral, traditional ways and meet futuristic sounds. Black and Daily Friday, blood and sport, ready, ready, free, see, yeah, join me at 11 every Friday, for some Black and Daily sound, free, see, community radio, 8:55 on your end, Black and Daily Friday, blood and sport, ready, ready, free, see, yeah, join me at 11 every Friday, for some Black and Daily sound, free, see, community radio, 8:55 on your end, voice of the people, the people. Black and Daily Friday, blood and sport, ready, ready.
And we are now joined in the studio by multi-award-winning author Tony Birch to discuss the upcoming launch of Pictures of You, a selection of some of the best of his short fiction works over the past two decades. And this collection brings together some of Birch's most poignant stories, taking readers through the humor, heartbreak, and rich complexity of everyday human experience. Pictures of You is published by the University of Queensland Press and hits bookstores on the 30th of September. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for coming in. It's always a pleasure to have somebody in the studio for an interview.
I love coming into the studio, but it's not far from home, so it's easy to get here.
True. Well, I am going to ask you a question about being in this place. So something that's always really stood out to me in your writing is how evocatively you create a sense of place. And so speaking from where we are now at 3CR, can you talk about how this place in the area of Fitzroy, Collingwood and Carlton in particular have shaped and continue to influence your writing?
Yeah, well, obviously I've spent most of my life in the inner city and spent a lot of my childhood here in Fitzroy. And even when we moved away, we didn't go far. I've lived in Richmond on Housing Commission, lived in Collingwood, lived in Carlton. So always I've lived in the inner city. I've always been a lifelong walker as well, so that, you know, even now I'm 68, I just got my driver's license, but I haven't really got behind a wheel yet. I'm not game. So I walk everywhere. I take a lot of photographs. Obviously, I have a lot of strong memories of place, so it does become very evocative. Even though the stories may or may not be autobiographical, it's that I will get triggers or memories of place that really evoke stories. It's often been hard for me to write about other places. I remember as a teenager, I used to swim at the Yarra River under a bridge called the Catwalk Bridge, and I would gaze across the river to Hawthorne, and I always wondered what they do in Hawthorne. I still wonder what people do who live in Hawthorne, and I don't know if they have any writers, but I'd like something salacious to come out of Hawthorne. I just feel that this is my place. I feel that there are important stories to tell about this place. So one of the things I was thinking about walking up this morning, you know, when you think about issues around homelessness around the inner city, I've written, you know, homeless characters into a lot of my fiction, and I hope I've done that with respect, because I feel that people who are regarded on the margins of urban society, and of course the Aboriginal community of Fitzroy as well, that I like to create characters who allow me to place those sort of issues and those people at the centre of Fitzroy life and inner city life. So they are my people. It might sound patronising, but I feel at home with people who are not otherwise welcome in suburbs like this anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's been all the more present as a concern when we think about this next wave of urban renewal that's coming through with the public housing redevelopment that's been planned by the state government. And I guess I wanted to turn to asking about how pictures of you came together. So what was the process of revisiting and selecting and then placing these stories together in this collection?
Well, first of all, it was just a wonderful experience. I've published 5 short story collections, and I think there would have been about 70 or 80 stories to choose from, and I could have included stories that have been published individually. To be quite honest, it's a bit like making a mixtape that you really love. So I didn't talk to the publisher about what they thought would work. I just felt that of the 22 stories I think there are, that they were my favourites, and for different reasons, so that clearly there are issues important to me, like family violence. So I have written fiction based on my childhood experience of family violence. But there are also some what I might call very quiet stories in the collection, which might convey an evolution in me as a writer, although my most recent novel, Women and Children, is also about family violence. I think it's I wanted to show some range in my writing, and I wanted to, there are particular stories, a story, one of my all-time favourite stories, Bobby Moses, about an old Aboriginal man who's dying and wants to go home to country. I love that story, and I based that story or the character on Jackie Charles, who was a great mate of mine, and Jackie died not long after that story was published. So one of the reasons for publishing that is that I love it, but again, to pay respect to people who are important in my life. I mean, it's not unusual in my novels, like when I wrote The White Girl, to have characters called Lydia and Alma and Sissy, who are part of the Great Thorpe family. So I always try to give cameos to my Aboriginal family. I have a prisoner called Foley in my new novel, which it may be a coincidence.
Yes, a fascinating coincidence. But I also, love Bobby Moses and the way that there is that quiet dignity that really comes through the character. I think about Amy McQuire's writing on the notion of presencing and the way that that really feels, so resonant with the characters that you develop in your stories.
Yeah, and I think with Bobby Moses and thinking about Jackie, it might seem like an odd story because he and the policeman on the highway who could do really serious damage to Bobby, they negotiate something of a peace deal. And that might seem a bit too fanciful, but it's not, because if you knew Jackie, Jackie knew how to negotiate the street. And part of Jackie's negotiation through his life, wherever he'd been in prison or working in the arts or being a respected elder, was to try and find ways to negotiate with anyone. I've seen Jackie calm a policeman in the street when that policeman might otherwise have harmed another Aboriginal person. So Jackie would see his role. All right, we know who the police are, but what I'm interested in here is to stop violence. So he was very good at charming and disarming people, which is a great skill of his.
Yeah, that's a really beautiful, a beautiful way to honour that complexity. And I wanted to ask as well about the cover photo on the dust jacket, and maybe as well about, the dedication as well on the back.
I love the photograph. So it's a photograph taken at Photo Booth on Flinders Street about 1970, so it's very old. It's a photograph of my younger brother Wayne and my little sister Tracy, who's sort of just poking her head up. So it's sort of a badly framed photograph in some ways, but I think it's wonderful. It's a photograph of my brother who died very suddenly 6 years ago now. He grew up in Fitzroy with us. He suffered a lot of mental illnesses as an older person. And I love that photograph of him because he's simply so beautiful. And, I mean, it's a very soft, beautiful photograph. And my brother went through a dramatic physical transformation in later life. And, there was nothing, any shame in that. But my mother particularly loves that photograph and wanted me to use it because she wanted people to see how beautiful he was. And I've said this before that, in a family of 6 children, you would have thought he was adopted because the rest of us have pretty rough heads. And he was always this angelic, beautiful child. So I feel so attached to the photograph. And I was really rapt when my sister saw it, my mum saw it, and it's so important to us. But it also works. I think it works in a sense of design. So my book designer is a Larrakia woman, Jenna Lee, who's worked on most of my books with UKP. and I work closely with her about how to design covers, and she has done this book and other books, and I'm just really happy and proud to have worked with her.
Yeah, I love the hat motif. And it is, well, look, people are going to have to go out and get the book so that they can see it.
Or borrow it from the library, I don't
mind. That is true. Ask your local library. You can always ask them to get a book in.
Yeah.
So, yes, getting back to the dust jacket and tying into the dedications on the back to Sara Saleh, Randa Abdel Fattah and Omar Sekar, I wanted to ask about that and maybe, you know, weaving that into the role of storytelling as a form of communication about the most important things in our world.
Well, each of those three writers are great friends of mine. They are great writers. They've also been very active in recent years in support of the nation and community of Gaza, been very vocal on the attempts to destroy Gaza, the genocidal intent of the Israeli Defense Force. And because of their courage and bravery, they've really suffered extreme abuse, I think violent abuse, and in the case of Randa in particular, attempts to destroy her as a person and her writing career. So we've dealt with some issues together over the last couple of years. My role is just to give them as much support as I can, and we particular in this year have had some very difficult issues to deal with, and we've just made a point of sticking close to each other, and I wanted to name them. That dedication also extends to making a comment about the cowardice of people in 2025, and what I mean by that is that the cowardice of not those who speak out in support of Israel, those who sit on their hands and say nothing when terrible things are being done. So I love all those people dearly, and I think their courage is amazing, as is the courage of all Palestinians living in Australia who get out on the streets and speak up for their community. And I think for the rest of us, we have an important role to play to support those people.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the way that we've seen silencing play out, you know, not just in the literary industry, but across society in Australia in relation to Palestine and the genocide has been, you know, immensely harmful. And I guess I also wanted to ask about the importance of intentionally making or preserving space for storytelling. And here I wanted to ask about your reflections on the closure of Mianjin.
Yeah, well, I've been very active on this in recent weeks. I mean, not publicly, because there are people doing that. By that, I mean, if I could just make the point that my first academic article was published in Mianjin. I think I've probably published at least 10 pieces of writing in Mianjin, you know, in so-called academic essays, certainly in short fiction and poetry. I made a statement or a joint statement with other people from the creative writing program at Melbourne University recently that Mianjin is its continuation is vital to the support of young emerging writers, writers of colour, certainly to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander writers. Historically, Mianjin have been great supporters of us, and that if we don't have journals, magazines like Mianjin around it, it just lessens the opportunity for younger writers to be published. So that's vital and that's obvious. What we've done in recent weeks, we've done things like I am technically the chair of Australian Literature at the University of Melbourne. So I've written several times to the Vice Chancellor of the University to raise the issue and haven't had a response. But I am able to say, and I don't know the detail, there is now a shift in the decision. And I know that a working group has been established. I was in a meeting yesterday, and a working group has been established. We want to bring Mianjin back into the university, and hopefully Mianjin will continue to operate within the Faculty of Arts, probably in my school, the School of Culture and Communication. Now, that's a fair way down the track, but I suppose the point to make, and I made this at a university meeting earlier this week, is that what we feel is shameful is that the decision was made with no discussion as to how, if there were financial issues, if there were, that there was no discussion held with university staff about how we might deal with that and how we might alleviate that. So it's a very, very strange decision to make.
Mm. University of Melbourne, famously financially constrained. Now, I just wanted to ask, to wrap up, what you're reading right now, and are there any up-and-coming writers whose work you'd like to see more widely recognised?
Well, I'd like to see up-and-coming writers, all of them, more widely recognised, but I've come with a recommendation. I've also come with a book, and I don't know how you people do this. I'm going to give you this book, so you're going to give it away somehow. Or
we'll figure it out.
People rush to the doors or something. So this is a first book by a Palestinian-Australian writer, Michaela Saha, and the title of the book is Find Me at the Jaffa Gate. It's a Palestinian family memoir. I know Michaela personally. This is a really important book for people who want to understand the struggles of the people of Palestine. So I would recommend that. Not as a newer writer, but I know Rhonda has a new novel out, Discipline. I think you should read that. But if I could just say generally, what I found in the last 2 years is that I have spoken publicly in support of Palestinians, but I pulled back a little bit on that because my sense is, one is I need to be a listener as much as a speaker or more, so I need to listen to our Palestinian comrades and friends. Secondly, I really spend as much time as I can reading Palestinian writers. So I think for all of us, it's important to give support and it's important to be active, but I think we need to make sure that we are standing with our friends, not speaking on their behalf, and also that we're educating ourselves. And what I found by reading, whether it be fiction, poetry or nonfiction, I've always been someone who wanted to be aware of what's happening in Gaza historically, and I would think, I know a bit. I realised that I didn't know anything like I need to know, and I'm still on that journey. So I would urge everyone to read as many Palestinian writers, both in Australia and internationally, as you can, because you will become better informed. And if you attack because someone says, oh, you don't understand history, well, you can say, no, I do understand history, and you're wrong.
Yeah, that is a perfect way to leave it. And, at least from my own experience, you read Palestinian writing and it will change you forever, and you won't be able to see things differently. So, Tony, thank you so much again for joining us. We will figure out a way to sort out the giveaway. Just really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And you are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
And now we are joined by Akshay Gori, the maker of the short film Sister Mine, where Amarjeet is sent to Melbourne with a tragic mission to protect his family's honour by taking his sister's life, who has had an inter-caste marriage. He instead finds love and warmth and conflict in the home of the woman he was meant to destroy. Sister Mine is a beautiful story of cultural pressure, sibling love and humanity winning over hate. Akshay Gori is a screenwriter and director who has made over 8 short films, both fiction and non-fiction. And again, if you need support, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. Now, the caste system in India has existed in some form for over 2,000 to 3,000 years. It's a social hierarchy that's rigid, passed down through families and lineages, and dictates the profession the person can work, as well as most aspects of their social lives, including who they can marry. While it has its roots in Hinduism and its traditions, nearly all Indians today identify or are assigned a caste, regardless of their religion. You're born into it, you can't change it. These have existed for centuries, and British rule really seek to further cement this to enforce categorization, dehumanization, and violence. The caste system, Varna, is rigid, hierarchical, birth-based, with roots in Hinduism, and informs the current classifications of the population of India today with this majority ruling. General caste, sometimes called forward caste, with Brahmins being at the very top, called the priests or the teachers, along with the most privileged caste, make up around 30% of the population, according to a 2025 survey. The Varna system has four classifications. Brahmins at the very top. And we have scheduled caste Dalit and scheduled tribe Adivasi. These are the most oppressed socioeconomic groups at the bottom. They often exist outside of the caste system, with Dalits also being known as the, quote, untouchables, where you are essentially not allowed to see them, touch them, share a meal, share water, share location. Dalit meaning untouchable and Adivasi meaning original inhabitants also can carry significant stigma and history, but also some groups have preferred to reclaim these terms. But some also prefer more constitutional terms of scheduled caste or scheduled tribe. This make up around 16% and 8% of the population, according to a 2011 census. Then, everything in between, basically, is what India classifies the other backward classes. So basically, if you're not at the very top, or you're not a scheduled tribe or a scheduled caste, you are other backward class, who are also socioeconomically marginalized and disadvantaged. People who are assigned the other backward classes are often descendants of India's indigenous communities, which further amplifies its discrimination. They make up around 41% of India's population, according to a 2026 survey. Despite post-independent constitutional rights and affirmative action, caste violence has become India's new normal. Dalits, particularly Dalit women, experience daily horrors that are truly unconscionable, from a Dalit child being killed by their teacher for simply touching a water pot, to being kidnapped to university and tortured by upper caste students, to being lynched for accidentally walking through an upper caste area. These are not just personal. These are systemic, deeply ingrained, and difficult to receive criminal justice trials, if they are even taken seriously, if they are even reported at all. While they say there's constitutional rights and affirmative actions, this is not always practice. We also see the most caste-based violence in BJP, Hindu nationalist, majority-run states such as Uttar Pradesh with the highest level. However, caste systems can look different in different states such as Tamil Nadu and Punjab in India. There's also a Punjab in Pakistan, we always forget about that. In Punjab, in India, Brahmins don't necessarily hold the same social control in the same way. As Punjab is mainly an agricultural society, those who own the most land, or jats as they're called, hold the most social control. There's a sentiment in Punjab that caste doesn't exist here, as it's not really a Hindu majority state. But all chief ministers of Punjab have been from jat backgrounds. Most political parties in Punjab have had a jat leader. They also own most of the agricultural land. And even when attempts have been made to redistribute land ownership to more caste oppressed groups, jats often use bribes, social force, social control, to buy proxy votes. And when you're economically disadvantaged, you can't really say no. Nearly all landless labourers come from the scheduled caste backgrounds. And while people say caste doesn't matter, we don't see it in Punjab. Caste remains a vital aspect of marriage, often protected by marrying only within your caste groups, and Dalit Sikhs often reporting facing abuse and discrimination at the hands of Jat Sikhs, here as well as in the diaspora. Most people, especially those from more privileged or quote-unquote upper castes, only date within their caste, have majority friends from their caste, mainly state they would refuse to be neighbours with someone of a lower caste, and marry only within their caste. With this very brief foundation knowledge that we could speak about for a long time, let's look at how it interplays with patriarchy, family, conformity, femicide, and violence.
Thanks so much, Akshay, for joining us. And I know that your film, Sister Mind, opens up a scene of the patriarch of the family saying, "Nothing can help now. I wish she had died just as soon as she was born. Give me poison. End this once and for all." It's a really sharp, painful line that holds the weight of 1,000 cuts and generational honour and femicides in this one sentence. Why choose this opening scene and this dialogue to open the film with?
Thanks for having me on the show, Ines. And actually, thanks for that very well-detailed introduction about caste. A lot of people do not know enough about it or just ignore it. And thanks for bringing up that horrific and very well-detailed analysis. As for now, the opening of my film, it is, as you've said, I think it is because of all of those reasons that I put that line at the very opening. It does say pretty much everything about how honor is defined in our societies, which are extremely patriarchal. It is defined by control, especially over women and over all the marginalized. And I think that is why that opening was very important. There is also a narrative reason for that as well. So for a 20-minute short film, it is very important to establish the stakes right at the front, right up front. So I did try to do that in the first minute and a half of the film to let the audience know what the film is about.
Yeah, amazing. I think also being from a Punjabi background and living, experiencing the gender-based violence, it was a really moving an important watch, and it was really, what also really struck me is when they go to the son and they say, if you have any shame, you would bring back your sister's severed head. That's so graphic and intense, and saying only then you can save your dad's honor, only you can clean up her mess now. So much of, you know, families and societies only seem to praise masculinity and honor when it's enacted through the violence against women. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, it is horrible that that is true. And I think the primary reason for it is to hold on to power, to hold on to the already established hegemony of men, upper caste men especially, but yep, men in general as well, dominating and controlling, like I said, women's bodies, their autonomy, their agency, and them wanting to be, you know, decision makers for anything and everything in life. I think it stems from that, that a certain kind of trait is cherished in our society, which is very, very toxic. And so there are both sides of it. Of course, men growing up as well kind of have to conform to that toxic trait. And it is very, very dangerous and very damaging for them as well. But much, much more damaging it is for women, for all the other genders, and for people from the so-called backward or scheduled class.
Yeah, I really appreciated how it's really a masterclass in the control of tone and tension. You know, I found myself like holding my breath, unsure of what's about to happen, and then being really comforted by their relationship, and then, you know, bringing in a perfectly timed instrumental to kind of release that breath. It was so clearly like thought out in every single beat. But what was the tension that you kind of wanted to display between all the relationships and really help the audience feel that?
Yeah, thank you for that comment.
That's okay. It's true.
Thanks. So basically, I wanted to examine the tension primarily between the relationship of the brother and the sister, the brother who has been sent to have to murder his sister, whether or not he wants to do it or will be able to do it or will ever do it is a different question altogether. So it's primarily an exploration of their relationship, which growing up for them has been very close. They have been pretty close. They actually do love each other as siblings. Then there is another layer of exploration of relationships, which is between this brother and his brother-in-law, the husband of the sister, who is from the scheduled caste. And how the brother, irrespective of his love for his sister, how he still looks down upon the husband, how he blames the husband in his own head for things going sour in his family. So I wanted to explore those tensions. Apart from that, again, from a narrative filmmaking point of view, I also wanted to explore elements of the thriller genre within a broader drama genre.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you definitely feel those influences. And knowing how close their relationship was, and even though he can try to like reconcile and really hold his like family's honor and try to mediate all this within that, how he still looks down on the husband. I think that's a really important point. Yeah. And particularly when we're first introduced to the sweet sister, We see a range of well taken care of plants, protest posters on her walls in her place in Melbourne, and she still remembers the way that he takes his coffee. What do you think this tells us about their relationship and her?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for noticing all of that, all that production design. I think it proves that it works.
Yes.
In the film. So basically, it tells you up front when they first meet that they have been very close. The sister has always taken care of him. She's the elder one. And especially in our societies, being elder becomes, you know, a whole new role as well. She's almost been a mother to him. Almost. So there is that closeness still there. And even the brother reciprocates it, even though he is tentative because he is weighed down under the task that he's supposed to do. But there is that closeness. The other thing through the production design that I wanted to elaborate was the fact that she has kind of broken away from the chains that had been holding her back while she was growing up, and she has become this woman who will say, who will speak up for herself, who will stand for herself and make her decisions on her own.
Yeah. The breaking away is so important, and to be able to show that through the set design and little things, but I think particularly around how much she looks after him, and how parentified, yeah, the eldest daughter role is. And going back to their, you know, inter-caste marriage, there's such a misconception that caste only really exists in, like, Hindu-majority countries or states, and that it just simply does not exist in Punjab and the diaspora. That everybody gets along, and it's not based in the Hindu-based runner system that it's rooted in. There's so many reasons for this, but yeah, do you want to talk us through why? Why is it that particularly in Punjab, it's just completely, we're fine, everybody gets along.
Yeah, well, thanks for bringing it up, because I've been getting a lot of these comments by people who are saying, oh, it does not exist in Punjab, it happens in Haryana or Rajasthan or Uttar Pradesh. Well, I think it's very, very easy to always shove the blame on the next person and be in denial about what one does themselves. I think it is because of that. But more importantly, I think it is because denial is a form of privilege.
Absolutely.
Someone in privilege, someone who wields power, will always say that they are doing nothing wrong whatsoever. And I think that is a classic case that has been happening here. So unfortunately, caste has gone well beyond the boundaries of Hinduism and that particular religion. It has become the reality of entire South Asia and also the diaspora all across the world. And 750 AD was when Islam came to India. It did not have caste back then, but very quickly, even Islam in India and in the entire subcontinent started having these castes. Sikhism was born out of the need for not having caste,
exactly.
Born out of the need for equality, and yet it has those castes. When I go to Punjab, there are people from the scheduled castes who still live in segregated areas.
Yep.
They cannot enter the fields of the upper caste people, as you've already pointed out, and they get brutalized if they drink from the same well, or if you know, they touch the powerful people. So it's absolutely appalling. And what's worse is this very privileged ignorance of the fact that it does not exist.
Yeah, I think sometimes with Punjab, particularly in India, it's if you come from like Sikh and Punjab, like farming families, or you're living in non-scheduled caste areas, there is such an apathy where you say it doesn't exist. And I remember speaking to some people about that, and just talking about their lives in Punjab, and then they were saying, oh yeah, no, that doesn't happen. But when the cleaner comes over, we use a different sponge, we use different plates, we use different forks. She's not allowed to sit on the furniture. Right, but caste doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Sure. But I sit on the floor with her and I talk to her. Okay. I think that's hard because, like, yes, in Punjab, in Hindu majority India, you are oppressed, but you're still North Indian and you're still within the caste structure more privileged. And it feels like sometimes really hard to acknowledge that. And I know that even with the resurgence of Bhangra music and, you know, we hear every single song is like jut, 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 everything.
Yes.
But because it's not, like, Brahmins, priests are not, have the same standing in Punjab, when it's agricultural land and all the landowners are jut, it really, that's how it amplifies.
Absolutely. So there is that very important intersectionality between caste and class as well.
Yeah.
And in the different religions as well, there is that intersectionality with caste. And I think it is very important that we try and understand how that works. I think there is one other thing that I would also like to point out. It is that caste system is very, very much like the racist system, racism. And yet, unfortunately, the world has not spoken enough about it. The people who have been oppressed by it have been trying to speak out, but they haven't been allowed to. Yes, they are fighting for it, and they must continue, but everyone else must also come in and speak up about it, because one in four people in the entire world face this.
Yeah. And it was only recently where Hari Om, who was a Dalit man, was accidentally looking for his wife, who's a sweeper, and wanders into a village of a more privileged caste, and they lynch him for accidentally simply walking through. And if you go on Dalit history on Instagram, you'll see horrific daily horrors. And, you know, I know we're speaking about this from a relatively privileged position right now, but I'm curious to know how the festival and premiere circuit has been. Because one, you're making a movie about femicide, then you're making a movie about caste violence, and then also from a Punjabi North Indian farming family. It's honestly so important and so courageous, but it's not lost on me that most likely screenings, actors, yourselves would be censored and or attacked for even making this, let alone showing this. So how are you getting the film out there?
Yeah, that's a very, very tough question to answer. At the moment, thankfully, the film is doing relatively well at the festival circuit, and it is traveling to international film festivals, playing on October 12th in Toronto at the South Asian Film Festival there up next, and it will hopefully go to a few more festivals. That's only one route, however. I've had a few private screenings of it here in Melbourne, in Kolkata, and in Rohtak, which is my hometown. And there has been very polar opposite reaction to it. I have had a lot of support, a lot of love. And at the same time, I've had comments that this is absolutely untrue and this is defamation. And why are you even making this film and all of that? So it's been kind of a tough journey. After the festival circuit, I do want to release it on my own small little YouTube channel. I have a few of my previous short films on that channel as well, and I would like to add this to the channel. It's the channel is in my own name. It is Akshay Gouri, G-O-U-R-I, and I would request all the listeners and you to check it out, please.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Akshay. We'll put that all in our show notes. And that's Akshay Gouri, G-O-U-R-I, the maker of the short film Sister Mine.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua. Yeah.
You've just listened to Thursday Breakfast's summer programming special on 3CR Community Radio. Today's show featured a selection of interviews we've done with artists, writers, video game designers, and filmmakers. We heard about the importance of Disabled Oracles, the first ever Aboriginal mobile game, the Family Music Collective's EP Bloodfire, and the short film Sister Mine and Fighting Against Carcism. Stay tuned for 3CR 855 AM, 3CR Digital, and streaming at 3cr.org.au or via the Community Radio app. And for next week, for the rest of our summer programming.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.